We don't yet know whom President Obama will pick for his Supreme Court nominee, but chances are pretty good that the person might be a graduate of Harvard or Yale law schools. Since 1988, the majority of justices attended Harvard or Yale law. Since 2010, it's been 100%. In other words, the Supreme Court might as well be covered in ivy. And there are a lot of people who say that's a problem. Lucas Poe Jr. is a law professor at the University of Texas, Austin, and a Supreme Court historian, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you.
First of all, I wonder if I might start by reading you a short quotation from Dahlia Lithwick, a longtime Supreme Court reporter, who a couple years ago wrote this about the Harvard-Yale lock on the Supreme Court. She wrote, "There is not a single justice from the heartland. There are no war veterans or capital defense attorneys. The Supreme Court that decided Brown v. Board of Education had 5 members who had served in elected office. The Roberts Court has none. What we have instead are 9 perfect judicial thoroughbreds who have spent their entire adulthoods on the same lofty, narrow trajectory." Obviously, Dahlia thinks there's a problem with that. Do you?
I agree with her completely. There's just something wrong when you think that only Harvard and Yale are capable of producing Supreme Court justices. And the court that decided Brown versus Board of Education had 9 men who had wide experience all through the United States in government.
You know, so this idea that all the justices come from either Harvard or Yale, I mean, to be specific, Ruth Bader Ginsburg graduated from Columbia, but she started her law school education at Harvard. I mean, it really brings into focus a lacking of 3 different types of diversity. Obviously, there's educational diversity. There's also diversity of experience and geographic diversity. I mean, how do these 3 things, why do they matter on the court?
Well, it seems to me that educational diversity, that if you're going to a law school not on the East Coast, you're likely to meet different people than are at Yale and Harvard, which are the 2 best law schools in the country. But there's a lot of other good law schools, and you'll get a much more diverse mix of classmates at the other law schools. And geographic diversity matters because, you know, the West is different from the East Coast, and water is so much more important in the West.
Right. So that gets me thinking of Sandra Day O'Connor, right, who grew up in Arizona, went to Stanford Law School, which, by the way, isn't shabby. It's currently, you know, right up there with Harvard and Yale. It's number 3. And in fact, looking at the other law schools out there, you know, kind of at the top of the heap, Stanford, Columbia, University of Chicago, University of Pennsylvania, Duke, Berkeley. I mean, there's a lot of geographic diversity in the cream of the crop law schools. But that aside, you were mentioning water and justices maybe not having a really tactile or first-person sense of how important these issues are. I mean, can you tell us more about that?
The West lives on water, and water law is a great component. And the interstate waterways are allocated by compact, and there's Supreme Court decisions on how you allocate it. And if I can use Justice O'Connor for a second, she grew up on a ranch that much of the land was controlled by the Bureau of Land Management. And she had a huge resentment of the federal government because she thought incompetent bureaucrats were constantly interfering with the way the ranch was operating.
Mm. So her personal experience there really informed, in a sense, part of her view of perhaps her role on the court. But let me ask you, I mean, there's this notion shared by many that Harvard and Yale, as the top 2 law schools in the country, by definition, are the places where you are going to find the best and brightest legal minds in America. And I mean, I'm looking at an April 2009 talk at American University Washington College of Law that was given by Justice Antonin Scalia, Harvard law grad, 1960. And he told a student how he chooses his clerks. And he said, quote, "From the law schools that basically are the hardest to get into, they admit the best and brightest, and they may not teach very well, but you can't make a sow's ear out of a silk purse. If they come in the best and the brightest, they're probably going to leave the best and the brightest." What's your response to that?
Well, he's clearly correct on one level. The people that graduate at the top of Yale and Harvard are extraordinarily able individuals. But a lot of people may not want to go to Yale or Harvard and may go to a Michigan or a Berkeley and can be just as good as the people who go to Yale and Harvard, but for their own personal reasons, have picked another school.
Well, so just to offer a little bit of pushback here, if I may, I mean, since what, 1988, Harvard or Yale Law School grads have represented the majority of the court. Since 2010, following the appointment of Elena Kagan, they were 100% of the court. Isn't part of the problem that the confirmation process itself is so fraught and that Harvard and Yale pedigree shields a nominee from criticism? I mean, I was looking back and remembering when President George W. Bush nominated Harriet Myers to succeed Sandra Day O'Connor. One of the points that were really hammered home by her opponents was that she attended the Dedman School of Law at Southern Methodist University.
Yes, there's no doubt that that factored against her, but there was much more. Her opponents who were pointing that out were Republicans, who were demanding that President Bush select somebody who had judicial experience so that the conservatives could be sure that that person had no liberal tendencies whatsoever. There's been a desire, especially among conservatives, for ideological purity on any nomination. You know, the idea that only two schools can produce the Supreme Court justices. We need more diversity on the court, not just gender diversity or racial diversity, but geographic diversity and experience diversity.
Yeah. You know, on the experience question, I remember that Justice Sandra Day O'Connor once said, when she was talking about the effect of having Thurgood Marshall sit beside her on the bench for those many years, she wrote that Justice Marshall imparted not only his legal acumen, but also his life experiences. And that constantly pushed and prodded the other members of the court to respond not only to the persuasiveness of legal arguments presented to them, but also the power of moral truth. Now, that may have worked for that court, but there are others who say that, you know, life experience and ideology shouldn't even play a role at all in questions of jurisprudence. I mean, wasn't it Chief Justice Roberts himself who once chided Justice Sotomayor for offering a dissent that included her personal life experience?
Yes, and personal life experiences matter. We don't leave them behind. Chief Justice Roberts was a corporate lawyer, and he turns out to like corporations a lot in his jurisprudence.
Mm. So here we are on the cusp of a new nomination to the nation's highest court. Chances are pretty good that maybe the Harvard-Yale pattern is going to continue. But if you had President Obama's ear, do you have people that you might suggest or notions that you might share with him that might change that?
Take a public defender from the West.
And why?
Because we have prosecutors on the Supreme Court. And they're well aware of how prosecution works. But there are people on the other side who are well aware of the abuses that prosecutors engage in. And a public defender would have that. And from the West, because the West is half the country and it deserves more than being flown over. I'd also note that if the Republicans successfully block any nomination and then Hillary Clinton wins the presidency, I would hope she would nominate Barack Obama to the court.
Then you'd get a former community organizer from Chicago.
And somebody that might have a little political experience.
Lucas Poe Jr. is a professor of law and government at the University of Texas, Austin. He's also a Supreme Court historian. Professor Poe, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.